Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Self-help books continue to be everywhere these days. In fact, it's become an industry in its own right, thanks to the Oprahs of the world in part. But have you ever wondered why there's so much interest in improving oneself with books and tapes? Well, my next guest has her own theory about this. She is the author of a new book that suggests that our self-help culture is a symptom of social unrest that has not found a political context. And we will ask her about that now. Mickey McGee is a sociologist and author of Self-Help, Inc., Makeover Culture in American Life, published by the Oxford University Press. She teaches at NYU. Dr. McGee, welcome to WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Nice to be here.
So you describe the interest in self-help as one of the most significant American social movements of the 20th century and now bleeding into the 21st. Before we get to this lack of political context, how do you see it as such an important social movement?
Well, what I see and what my research reveals is that self-help books in print have doubled since 1972. That is, the number of books in print has also increased, but the number of self-help books has outpaced growth in any other category. And interestingly, that parallels a decline in the wages for American workers. It directly parallels a decline. Since 1972, American workers have been earning less per week in average wages than ever before. We earn 17% less now than our parents earned in 1972.
So you think that you write, quote, Americans have been looking for answers to their social and economic problems in the self-help aisles of their bookstores rather than looking at their polling places, unquote. So you think that self-help is a substitute for political involvement?
Absolutely. Americans find themselves in a situation where their jobs are being outsourced and offshored. They find themselves at a moment when the costs for basics, for education, for housing, and for health care have far outpaced the rate of inflation. And at the same time, they find their jobs are unstable, insecure, and that they will have not just, you know, one or two jobs in a lifetime, but they may have five or six different types of jobs, different careers in a lifetime.
But don't we also find that self-help books sell remarkably well among the upper middle class and others who are comfortable in America?
Well, the idea that there is a very comfortable upper middle class in America is one that I think we probably need to investigate a little more, because most people in the U.S. describe themselves as middle class, but actually what we have is a new kind of poverty which is not continuous, but rather a poverty that is intermittent. So you'll find people who appear to be comfortable will suddenly find themselves unemployed or downsized or out of work, and at that moment enter the ranks of the poor, but don't appear to be poor. So I think there's an undercurrent of insecurity and sort of fear of falling or fear of economic decline that runs all across what we might view as an otherwise prosperous middle class. The middle class is not so prosperous as it is represented to be.
Yeah, but my question really was about the upper middle class, unless you think that's a figment as well.
I do.
Go ahead.
I mean, I think that there is an extremely wealthy elite in this country that has an enormous percentage of the wealth of the nation, indeed of the world. And then there's enormous economic inequality that has grown during the same period when real wages have been in decline. So I think that that's what we're looking at, is we're looking at people who have an insecure sense of where their economic future lies. And so, as a consequence, turn to self-help books to find ways to work on themselves. People want to remain not only employed, but also employable, and in a sense become the products of their own labor. They become belabored. They have to work on themselves to remain employable. And that's what I look at in Self-Help, Inc.
We can take phone calls for our guest, Mickey McGee, author of Self-Help, Inc., Makeover Culture in American Life. Do you agree with her thesis that the self-help explosion is driven by economic insecurity and the lack of political involvement around that issue? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. How does this relate to the interest in 12-step programs, which you write about at some length in your book, which, of course, are targeted to alcoholism and other kinds of addiction?
Well, 12-step programs are very interesting because they're a very important social movement of the mid to late 20th century. But rather than having the possibility of a political discourse arise from that social movement, the language of the recovery movement always sort of folds back into the self and has an explicitly apolitical imperative. In other words, when you go to a self-help, an AA meeting or any of the recovery 12-step movement meetings, you're specifically asked not to have a dialogue with others. There's a rule against what's called crosstalk. That is to say, you can't actually build any kind of solidarity around a political issue when you're not allowed to sort of compare notes about social issues. The Alcoholics Anonymous movement is explicitly not politically engaged, and that's a very sad point, because had it been possible for those groups to have developed a more political base, we might not find ourselves in the situation that we find ourselves today in terms of our political situation.
So here's a part of a critique of your book from the website Salon.com. It says, as shrewd as McGee is at teasing out the anxieties underlining our makeover fantasies, her views on the possible solutions are founded in an unexamined quasi-Marxism. This makes them seem as elusive as the promises of Tony Robbins and his ilk. Throughout Self-Help, Inc., she evaluates all self-help trends on the basis of how likely they are to lead to, quote, progressive, even radical, political activism. Perhaps she suggests the inward-looking little communities formed to follow 12-step programs can be encouraged to agitate for economic justice and the redistribution of resources and opportunities. So first, do you consider yourself a quasi-Marxist?
Well, I would prefer to step away from any label, but particularly a label that starts with quasi. But that being said, I think of myself as someone who's very committed to economic and social justice, and at other moments in history, Marxism might have been a route to get there. There are still some very valuable things to be learned from the venerable philosopher Karl Marx, but I wouldn't call myself any particular ism at this point.
Mm-hmm. The writer here says she evaluates all self-help trends on the basis of how likely they are to lead to progressive, even radical political activism. Do you think that should be the only basis? I mean, what about, you know, psychological self-help having to do with the scars that your parents left you with, or, you know, spiritual self-help having to do with people's quest for inner meaning, all of those things? Do you write them all off as a substitute for economic justice?
Do I write them all off? I would say that what you're quoting from is one person's opinion, Laura Miller's review in Salon, where she was actually very positive about Self-Help, Inc., and said it really nailed the political and philosophical issues involved in the rise of self-help culture. What I like to say about self-help culture is I'm not for it or against it. I mean, the idea that one could be for or against something that's such a vast and integrated part of American culture would be a little simplistic from my point of view. Rather, I'm interested in exploring the ways in which this culture might be extended. So rather than having makeover culture that asks us all to make ourselves over in the image of some televised visual beauty, for example, that instead we think about how we can make over culture itself so that it is more equitable, more organized to encourage overall human flourishing rather than what we currently have.
Mickey McGee, author of Self-Help, Inc., Makeover Culture in American Life, my guest on WNYC. Jill in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jill.
Hi. I find this conversation interesting, but I think a gigantic aspect is being overlooked, and that's the gender divide with self-help books. I worked in a bookstore for 3.5 years, and I don't think I ever sold a self-help book to a man once. Men don't think that they need to be made over or to be better lovers or parents or caregivers or interior designers. It's only women that come in that want to be, you know, improve themselves. And, you know, I'd be curious to hear what the author has to say. I think it's too broad. It seems too obvious to me that it's only women that think they...
And this might also be an interesting question for our next guest, who is the author of that new book that's causing a bit of a stir called Manliness. But Professor McGee, what do you think of that question?
Well, Jill, it's a great question. What most research, market research, shows is that self-help books are actually bought in equal numbers by men and women. But that is not to discount your experience working in a bookstore. What seems to happen is that men tend to buy books that are about career management and economics,
investment,
how to manage your
right.
finances, and women tend to buy the books that look more clearly, would seem to more clearly fall into the category that we think of as self-help or self-improvement or life makeover books. But actually, there's not a very big gender split if you look at the overall category of self-help.
Hmm.
Now, when you parse it out into the various subgenres in self-help, yes, there's a gender breakdown, for sure, absolutely, and what you observed is correct.
Jill, thank you for your call. And you say in the book that much of the success of the conservative movement in recent years comes down to the same reasons that made self-help such a success. What do they have in common?
Well, conservative political culture is based on two trends. One, a kind of market economy where you think of yourself as the CEO of Me, Inc., where you think of yourself as me first and everybody else, well, they come second and serve my needs. And then conservative culture also is based in a kind of traditionalist, religious, fundamentalist background. So conservative culture has these two very prominent trends. And self-help culture sort of feeds into those because there are different themes in the literature. Some are, like Tom Peters, the management guru, says, organized around, you know, inventing yourself as the CEO of yourself, and so applying a market principle to your personal life and to every angle of your life. And then more spiritual literatures like M. Scott Peck's The Road Less Traveled, for example, ask people to sort of turn the other cheek and engage in a kind of a Christian way of living their lives in the world. So both of those things are very resonant with conservative political culture in this country. So they're very tied into one another and support each other. There's internal conflicts and contradictions between those two threads, I might add, that are clearly apparent.
Dean in Berkeley Heights, you're on WNYC.
Hi, fascinating topic. I just wanted to point out that perhaps this genre of self-help has a longer history in American literature than it's being accounted for. I'm thinking particularly of Benjamin Franklin's autobiography, which is really a self-help manual in terms of setting forth a project by which more Benjamin Franklins can be produced and reproduced. And so I think in the collective American imaginary, there's a long history of this kind of movement towards self-help. And I think it's part of the American character in terms of some of the principles that we hold, and that is that we're a meritocracy, that we believe that, you know, if the individual can apply themselves, then they can succeed. So I'm just a little bit leery about mm-hmm. a complete economic explanation about.
And Dr. McGee, you do go back to Benjamin Franklin in your book.
Absolutely. Dean is absolutely correct. This is a longstanding part of American culture. And even before American culture, much of what one finds in Ben Franklin's writing actually comes from some British British religious tracts. So one sees that this comes out of an Anglo-American culture, and it's not at all something that's just emerged out of the blue, and I would be very reluctant to make any case that says that. Rather, what I point out is during this particular period, the last quarter of the 20th century and now into the 21st century, we've seen a huge increase in people's interest in these books. We've always had etiquette manuals, self-improvement books. Benjamin Franklin also wrote the quite incredible economic self-help book, The Way to Wealth. He was, you know, the Susie Orman of his day with his almanacs and his advice, his Poor Richard's Almanac. So he is the exemplar of the American self-made man, absolutely.
But he wasn't trying to compensate for an exploitative capitalism.
Well, he was actually doing something a little different. What he was doing is developing a new way of thinking about the self, unmoored from the traditional social classes of the European context. So, he was a person born a candlestick maker's son, becomes an apprentice printer, and then emerges as one of the great diplomats of the 18th century. So you see, he's working with a whole other set, and in the context of a whole other set of kind of radically changing social and economic forms.
David in Dix Hills, you're on WNYC. Hello, David.
Yeah, hi, how are you?
Okay.
I have a couple of comments. Two are related. One is that you had pointed it out yourself, that there's this kind of reductionism with respect to what are being called self-help books. I have a problem with the heading self-help books because I really don't know what that means. But the reductionism is a kind of Marxist kind of reductionism that says everything is reduced to the political or the social. And I have critiqued that notion for years. I think that is just a gloss on the reality of people's lives, which are very complex, very complicated.
And David, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're going to run out of time for this segment in a minute, and I want to give Dr. McGee a chance to answer your question. So go ahead, Dr. McGee.
Oh, I didn't get a question there.
Oh,
so
well,
he
was saying that he finds your book reductionist, so respond to the critique.
Well, I don't know that he's read the book, but it's certainly not reducing all of our experience to pure economics. Rather, what I look at is that there are economic forces that interplay with cultural and social forces that produce a phenomenon like self-help culture.
Some people say Oprah could be president, so maybe the people have got the self-help and the political all mixed up.
But in some ways, Oprah has more influence than the president at this point. She has more personal influence in people's lives. Oprah has a better job than the president at this point. And she would probably never run for president, certainly doesn't weigh in terms of what political candidates to endorse even. So, yeah, absolutely. I mean, Oprah could be president, but she would probably choose not to because being the head of a self-help empire is a
McGee.
Much better gig.
Her new book, Self-Help, Inc., Makeover Culture in American Life, published by the Oxford University Press. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brian.